Do you know any Christmas songs you could start us off with?
Well, I was working on the band's version of Bruce Springsteen's Atlantic City, which may or may not take place at Christmas. I like to believe that, like, the couple in question, it's a Christmas fight out on the promenade, you know? When permission is all in town for Christmas.
Wow, they blew up the Chicken Man on Christmas Eve?
On Christmas Eve, yeah. That sounds like, it's like grandma got hit by a, like, run over
by a reindeer, yeah.
Chicken Man got run over by a reindeer. All right, it is our annual Christmas episode, and for long-time listeners of the show know that we have a little Christmas tradition here at the Antifada, where we, for some reason, talk about anti-Semitism.
This doesn't only happen on years when Hanukkah and Christmas start at the same exact night.
Which is itself anti-Semitic. Christmas should have to move.
I think Hanukkah itself is vaguely anti-Semitic, to be quite honest with you. Let's invent a holiday so Jewish kids don't feel bad.
All right, they didn't invent
Hanukkah. Yeah, but they elevated its importance.
And let's elevate
it. From its apocryphal status, yeah.
I feel kind of ambivalent about being enthusiastic about the Maccabees, who I feel like were kind of the Taliban of their day.
Yeah, the Antioch Greeks were cool.
they were possibly
controversial opinion.
The cosmopolitan Greeks.
Yeah, they were fighting against the Hellenized Jews, who I think in their day were exactly more cosmopolitan.
The Greek cosmopolitan
days. It was like a culture war.
It was. All right, we have a very exciting episode for you. We will be talking about the movie The Brutalist. New movie just came out. Very interesting ending. We will try to save the heavy spoilers for the second half and sort of talk about Bauhaus and brutalism in the first half. And the absolute best guests we could have to talk about this subject are with us. We have Ross Wolf. You all know him. You love him. And his wife, who is a brutalism scholar in her own right, Susanna Grossman Wolf.
Hello. First appearance on the podcast, but not first appearance in our life. Good to see you.
Oh, hi. Good to see you guys.
She was in person.
I haven't really been a brutalism scholar since my undergrad days, but I appreciate the plug there. But I will talk intelligently, I hope, about the subject.
Before we get into that, just tell us the story of how the two brutalists got together and fell in love and got married.
Ross, did you meet at a
1960s hospital or something? How did that happen?
We were just hanging around a concrete mixer, you know.
We're hoping you stand the test of time, just as all that concrete.
No, we joke that our wedding cake should be made to look like a slab of concrete, but it didn't actually happen. Ross, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I can remember it like it was yesterday. It was really, very surprising for me. We met through a friend, Danny Colligan, at our friends Leif and Maya's house. So Leif teaches German studies at NYU. His wife, Maya, she teaches Slavic literature. And they were screening Bertolucci's The Conformist, a classic movie. Ironically, I've heard some people try to compare this film that we're reviewing today by Brady Corbet to Bertolucci films. I don't think that comparison really stands up. But in any case, we were not at all.
Not enough weird sex.
Yeah. There was a bit in the movie.
I don't know.
Not weird enough.
Yeah, there is an Italian connection. But in any case, in between, or right in the lead up to actually screening the movie, I had never met. This is my first time meeting Susanna. We were talking about what we were interested in, and I mentioned that I think Danny mentioned that I was interested in Soviet history and architecture, and so Susanna expressed that she, also had an interest in architecture and asked me what my taste was in architecture. And I said, modernism broadly, constructivism more specifically, but I had a great deal of appreciation for brutalism.
And how did you feel when Ross said that word, brutalism. What happened to you?
Putting the thing right on your finger then? Is that?
Well, I was really surprised as well, because I guess I hadn't really kept my finger on the pulse of architectural history and scholarship really since my days as an undergrad and then later as a grad student. So there had been, I guess, in a kind of brutalist appreciation revival movement happening in some, you know, pop culture currents, I guess, for some time. But I wasn't really aware of that. So I was really surprised and pleasantly surprised to hear him say that, because I had written my undergrad thesis for an art and architectural history degree on why brutalist architecture is important and should be preserved in state as it is, as opposed to what kind of preservation efforts for brutalist buildings in the mid-aughts and 2010s were kind of trying to update brutalist architecture in this really ugly way that I don't like very much. But in any case, I wasn't really aware that anybody, especially in the United States, had any interest at all whatsoever in brutalist architecture. And we'll talk about that a little bit, I guess, when we get into it. But for me, it's really associated with post-war Britain, much more so than any other time and place.
All right, we're talking about your love story here. Let's save talk about post-war Britain.
All this is to say, I was just really excited and didn't think anybody was at all interested in brutalism, and certainly not in, what year was that, Ross? Like 2019?
Yeah, that was toward the very end of 2019.
2019, yeah. So, so we started talking about that, and, you know, one thing led to another, and then we were married like 2 years later.
That's awesome.
It was a lovely wedding. There was
thank you.
Concrete in the middle of that.
No concrete. Very Jewish wedding, though, which we can also talk about in the context of reviewing this film. So when I saw that there was going to be a movie called The Brutalist, again, I got very excited because I thought it was going to be really about brutalist architecture, and we were sorely mistaken. So.
Yeah, so let me just tee up the movie, and Sean has not had a chance to see it, but the three of us had, so Sean will just add some comic relief to the episode, maybe some color mandolin commentary. Interstitials, yeah.
I did read a very long and I think good review of several recent books, brutalism books that Ross sent me earlier.
Oh, great.
Or yesterday. So, and I do, you know, I have to say, like, being a architecture fan, it's like very easy to have like passable views on architecture. And I would consider myself like an amateur architecture type guy. Like, I know what I like, and I do like brutalism. I like high modernism, and I even have some takes on it. So I won't like burden you guys too much with my amateurish takes on these things. And I haven't seen the movie, so I'm just going to kind of sit back and like shake my fist at the clouds, which I usually do, but I'll let you go ahead and do your thing, Andy.
Well, yeah, some of the movie deals with like the relationship between this architect and the crew building it, and the other architects and the financiers. So you might be interested in that from like your job.
Oh, but I do concrete. I mean, is one thing that I can say, like Beton Brut. Like, I know my way around that shit pretty good.
But just to intro the movie a bit for people who haven't seen it yet, and maybe by the end of this episode you will not want to see it, but from the trailer and the early reviews I had, and the impression that after a year of very disappointing new releases, for me at least, that this was going to be the movie of 2024. There were some early comparisons to There Will Be Blood and Oppenheimer, and it was advertised as an American epic, 3.5 hours long with a 15-minute intermission, which I did not see coming, but that was pretty nice. I got to sneak in to see Sonic 3 for a few minutes during the intermission. And directed by a young visionary, Brady Corbett, shot in a type of 35-millimeter film that Hitchcock used, but no movie since 1961 has had used. I guess except for End of Evangelion.
Yeah, the live-action portions of that, which I rewatched last night, are filmed in VistaVision, as one Twitter commenter pointed out.
Yeah, so a lot of weird, interesting stuff going on, but unfortunately, the second act of this movie, the wheels really fall off, or whatever the brutalist version of the wheels are. And then this element was introduced that kind of culminates the movie, and that very, you know, sort of disturbing to us, but it, to its credit, deserves a lot of consideration and discussion. So we will work our way there. But just to tee up the plot of this movie, it opens with Laszlo Toth, a fictional Bauhaus architect, refugee from a concentration camp in Europe, I believe Buchenwald, mm-hmm. making his way to the United States after the war. He has just received a letter from his wife, who he's been separated from, Elizabeth.
I can only imagine him portrayed as Laszlo from What We Do in the Shadows right now.
Vampire? Well, maybe to the wasps that he encounters. Yeah. He is kind of this vampiric, parasitic presence.
He is an old world brooding intellectual in a...
He's Hungarian. I don't know. Yeah. Transylvania.
He's like a Dorno in L.A.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of wish. Yeah, them. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There is a modern, you know, there is a certainly strain of emigres to Los Angeles who are associated with the Bauhaus as well. So, yeah, Dorno. What's the Neutra, I guess, is an architect. We went to see Adorno's modernist-ish house on Sunset Boulevard, actually. Ross, you remember?
Cool. It was actually Thomas Mons. He lived.
Right. He lived across the street from Adorno, and yeah. Adorno lived in a much less nice house.
It's Morrissey right. lives off Sunset Boulevard. I've been to his house to Morrissey.
Adorno's, they lived on a duplex near the Thomas Mons estate.
Anyway, sorry to derail.
Yeah. So he arrives in the United States. He goes to Philadelphia, where he has a childhood friend sponsoring him with a job at his furniture store. He begins making modernist furniture, and no one really understands what it is. It's like, what am I supposed to sit on this? What the hell is this? And
his childhood friend is Nandor. I'm just a huge fan of What We Do in the Shadows. I'm sorry. Go on.
Are you guys? It's good. It's worth watching, Andy, if you haven't seen it.
Oh yeah, yeah. I enjoy, okay. Especially the movie.
I think it's his cousin, actually. Which I don't mean to be pedantic about the details. Okay. But I think that does come. I think that is important that they're actual their blood relatives.
Right. Right. And very early on, there's a lot of culture shock. Like one of the first images we see is he emerges from the darkness of the ship to see the Statue of Liberty inverted upside down, and he visits
metaphor. Right? It's like a big flashing light metaphor.
But I was totally hooked from that moment, because it's got a great soundtrack by, I think his name's Daniel Blumfeld, really. Driving, like, There Will Be Blood sort of soundtrack that really hooks you in. And then there's, you know, these cultural tensions, like his cousin and has married a Catholic woman and converted to Catholicism. He's changed his name to an American name from, like, Molnar to Miller, I believe. And so the whole first act is him trying to get his footing as this, auteur architect, trying to work his way back up from someone who is building these important Bauhaus buildings in Europe, and I think specifically in Germany, and trying to make his mark in the United States. He gets commissioned to build this community center on the property of a wealthy patron named Harrison Van Buren. It was a very funny character. A lot of the first act is him... You know, this patron seems to really love his vision and want to support it 100%, but quickly he runs into problems with the neighboring town of Doylestown, Pennsylvania, who are suspicious of him as a foreigner, implicitly as a Jew, and they don't really talk about it much, but there seems to be a sense that people know that as a Bauhaus architect, he is something of a socialist, and so he has to defend his work to the rural Americans as, look, I'm building this community center. It's for you. It's, I'm going to build it with my vision, but it is meant to be for the people. There will be a church here. It'll be very Christian and all this stuff. And everything seems very good in the first half. So we'll work our way to the second half. But let's start off with Ross and Susanna describing what Bauhaus was and how it transitioned to brutalism and sort of the architectural context of this Laszlo Toth character.
Okay. Ross, do you want to take it? Yeah, why don't you start?
Yeah, so the Bauhaus was an extremely important retrospective after retrospective, starting, you know, with the Museum of Modern Art, just an extremely important school of art, architecture, and various crafts that opened in 1919. It was at three different locations. It was in Dessau, which is probably the most important period, though for the longest time it was at in Weimar. The first years were in Weimar. It did have kind of generically socialist origins. There was an American living in Germany, Lionel Feininger, who he made a very famous woodcut called The Cathedral of Socialism. And at the beginning, it had more kind of arts and crafts, Werkbund style, origins more expressionist, I would say. It moved more towards functionalism in the second half of its existence as part of its exchange, part of a broader dialogue that it had with Vutemas, which was in Moscow, and visits by constructivists like L. Lissitzky and Lissitzky's influence on Moholy Nagy, who is another Hungarian artist. And it did have this communist interlude. So after its first director, Walter Gropius, resigned in 1926, it was taken over, I think 1926 or 1928, I'm forgetting the year. It was taken over by Hannes Meyer, and Meyer was a card-carrying communist who was actually kicked out for that reason and replaced by Mies van der Rohe, who had designed the Rosa Luxemburg monument but was more apolitical. And later, it turned out to be he was willing to work with the Third Reich, actually, as was were some of his other students, Herbert Bayer specifically. But so it did have like these generically socialist origins and then a kind of communist interlude. And I think that there are allusions to that in the movie. It had a lot of different students from all over Europe. In fact, one of the names you mentioned, Molnar, his cousin's name is original name is Molnar, changed to Miller. One of the more interesting minor Bauhaus figures was, in terms of architecture, was this guy, Farkas Molnar. I'm not sure if that's an Easter egg that was deliberately implanted into the movie or not. But in any case, yeah, so he's supposed to be, there's some small indication of this, like in a conversation that he has with Harrison Van Buren, like at this party that's very comical on the one hand, but also very serious. Like there's kind of menacing undertones I found in watching it. Like he's just such a fish out of water, like, you know, cultured European Jew at this incredibly waspy dinner party and just experiencing all the culture shock that goes with that. And then later he has to justify it to this town hall. He, you know, alludes to, their ideological concerns, and he reassures them that he's really just interested in executing his artistic vision and that there is no deeper socialist ideology at work.
He does imply at some point that his ideology, because this Van Buren character likes to pick his brain a bit in a very superficial way, as, you know, I want to talk to this intellectual and have a stimulating intellectual conversations with this man. And at one point, he asks him to describe the nature of his art or the theory behind it. And he says something like, I want to create structures that withstand the test of history, and something about, providing impetus for the uprisings of the future or something like that. But that's about as political a statement that he ever makes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. I think, there are inherent contradictions within the nature of Van Buren's project. I think that he acknowledges slightly or at times or bristles at, but then they just kind of get washed away. So, you know, he at first expresses some hesitation when the son, Harry, I think his name is, the Joe Alwyn character, and who's kind of working on the project as a kind of project manager and budget manager, mentions that they'll get matching funds or they'll get state funding alongside the private funds if they dedicate a certain amount of space to Christian worship. And Laszlo questions that initially. I don't know if you remember, but just barely, he sort of says, oh, I thought this is supposed to be a community center for all. But then, you know, that just kind of gets washed away once Harry explains, well, we need these funds. So he sort of just kind of takes that in stride. And then also, you know, there's, I think, inherent contradictions too. And I guess we can talk about it a little bit more about, you know, the nature of a public community center that's still a part of the private grounds and estate of this like oligarch. And there's no planning around it. I was thinking about this as we were watching the film. Like, you still have to enter through the gates of the estate to access the property. There's no transit arranged for members of the town or outlying community to reach this space whenever it will open. I don't know if this is anything. I mean, maybe it's unimportant, but none of that seems to come up at all. And I think it maybe that is meant to kind of indicate how half cocked this plan is. I don't know, Andy, what do you think about that?
And just, yeah, you know, it's possible that they were going to cut a road at some point because it's a huge community center. There must be some real access, but yeah, I think it does. It is. That's part of the culture shock is like in Europe. I'm sure he was building structures that were funded by the Weimar state. But here he's building, he's at the mercy of this this wealthy shipping magnate, or maybe he's a shipbuilder. Wait. I think
no, he's a, so that comes up later. It's important to remember for later. He's a cargo shipping magnate. Mm-hmm. Which is why that the stuff with the train that happens later, I think that's part of, I think, right, that's supposed to color our understanding of Harrison Van Buren's business activities. So he's somebody who, I think the cousin says initially, he's figured out ways to make cargo shipping more efficient. And then later, when there's this, well, I don't know if I want to get into spoilers yet, but with the train accident,
mm-hmm.
Do you remember?
Yeah.
I think the implication is supposed to be like, oh, well, his mode of efficiency is just cutting corners, mm-hmm. that lead to industrial accidents. Like
America assholes.
Yeah, and the cutting corners like impinges upon the architectural project itself. So I've seen, right, there's a lot of commentary in the reviews that I've read about the sort of contradictions and challenges posed by architectural projects operating in capitalist society. I think as a medium, architecture, unlike certainly poetry or literature or even painting, I think it really requires you to marshal such vast resources in order to actually realize projects that it's bound up in very material ways with the functionings of the economy, more than any other medium, except maybe for actually cinema. Cinema also requires a lot of resources to really realize a project. And like there's a very, one of the main driving sources of conflict is between, you know, this sort of visionary, European modernist and, the different project managers who he's freighted with, who are trying to, who make alterations to the project without notifying him. And that he has to kind of, and he flies into these various rages. In fact, I think that this is where some of the more historical references in terms of like who Laszlo Toth is supposed to be based on, I think that's a bit more evident in those moments. So I don't know if we want to get into like who we're speculating might be like the origins for this character or who the historical referent might be. But I think that's one of the places where you see his personality really emerging.
Maybe just a note on the name.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I think probably a lot of people watching this film will have the experience of Googling this guy during the intermission and, you know, wondering if he was a real person or not. And they will find this has to be an intentional joke. They find the Wikipedia page for a man who vandalized Michelangelo's Pietà in 1971 or something like that. So that, I think that's sort of a joke on, like, you know, an underworld figure attacking a Christian, like defacing a symbol of Christendom or something, like a deeper alienating joke about the nature of Toth and like how he feels living in the United States. But yeah, in general, there's just this sense that his entire life's work had been bound up with the interwar period in Europe, or his entire identity as a Jew, as a socialist, as an artist, and that world is just gone. It's hopeless for him. You know, he's writing to his wife, who's is she in the Soviet? Is she behind the Iron Curtain at this point? I was unclear about where she was exactly.
So she ends up at Dachau, and he's at Buchenwald. So they're separated. Yeah. And she's a convert too. I mean, it's interesting all the different conversions.
Conversions in the story. Yeah. She's a convert to Judaism, as opposed to the cousin's wife, or as opposed to the cousin who converts to Catholicism.
And the lawyer of Van Buren.
His wife is also Jewish, a convert to Judaism as well. Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that.
So there's a lot of questions about it, like the validity of conversions and who recognizes it and when.
Right, and are you ever really accepted as a member of the community, which I guess like is applicable to this larger immigrant story too. Should we talk about, Ross gave a really good overview of the Bauhaus. Should we talk a little bit about specifically brutalism?
Yes, please.
Okay. So, I mean, I think in the film, the name The Brutalist is meant to have multiple meanings. And I think as audience members, we're supposed to question, like, who is really the brutalist? Is it this literal brutalist architecture? Is it, you know, someone brutalized or brutalizing someone else? You know, there's ambiguity. But I think, like, the kind of evocation of the specific architectural style is largely by happenstance, or maybe the filmmakers thought that this was clever, because the architecture that Laszlo Toth is associated with, and we see these projects in construction, are not brutalist at all. Like, they are much more in keeping with like a high modernist or international style of architecture that we associate, I think, with people like Frank Lloyd Wright and the Wax Building, or the Johnson and Wax Building. And you can see echoes of that in the building project as he's making it. There's echoes of Le Corbusier's Unité de Habitation, which is a big housing project that was built in Marseille in France. You know, the qualities of those buildings, I think, and Ross, you can chime in here too. They are kind of, simple geometry, minimalist shapes, very clean lines.
Machines for living.
Yeah, exactly. Machines for living, you know, an emphasis on the kind of lightness of form, you know, these sort of floating cities in space. Ross, do you want to help me out here?
Yeah, so...
Is there anything else I'm missing? You know, sort of, the international style is applicable to any kind of time or place or location or region. And that's what Laszlo Toth is concerned with building. Whereas brutalist architecture, at least for me, is much more the kind of lingua franca of post-war British architecture for some pretty specific reasons, which isn't to say there aren't brutalist buildings outside of Britain. There are, but you find, I think, their kind of purest manifestation there for pretty specific reasons, and which I'll get into in a sec. Ross, did you want to say something?
Yeah. So yeah, I agree that the actual like building style of the buildings that were shown, certainly of the 1930s projects, that there's a moment in the film where Van Buren realizes that Toth is a sort of architect of reputation, who did make a name for himself as kind of a virtuosic figure in the interwar period, in the 30s. I guess he would have been building. All those clippings, the newspaper clippings, are very much standard, like international style, very much like Mies van der Rohe, the sort of Frankfurt housing estates of the 1930s, of that style. And then the style of the actual memorial center that he constructs is more akin to, as you were saying, the wax building that with the pillars in the basement, and the sort of chapel section is very reminiscent of Ronchamp, which is
Le Corbusier, a late Le Corbusier, but Le Corbusier building in France.
But yeah, it's to sort of get into like the origins of brutalism as a style, because it's kind of interesting that brutalism was kind of an intervention and part of a conflict within modernism more broadly, it emerging, as Susanna alluded to, in post-war Britain. So the name comes from the French word for raw concrete, béton brut. And it's not because the buildings just look brutal, though many of them do. It's also somewhat related to Peter Smithson's nickname, which is Brutus, and Smithson and his wife were two of the sort of foundational figures in the brutalist movement. They were largely inspired by late period Corbusier, the Unité d'Habitation in Marseille, and there were some direct connections with constructivism via this other interwar European Jewish architect, Berthold Lubetkin, who was born in the USSR and attended Vutemas. His main saying was that he was a lifelong communist, openly so. He designed a number of buildings for the Communist Party, as did another figure who I think the Laszlo Toth character is meant to sort of be modeled after, though in a very different context. So Lubetkin was famous for the saying that nothing is too good for ordinary people. And this was sort of indicative of his belief of the social mission of architecture. He also designed a very charming, in my opinion, kind of brutalist penguin pool for the London Zoo. You should definitely Google
it. It's delightful. Yeah, look at pictures of it. It's absolutely delightful. Like, you know.
Yeah,
there's like penguins on water slides made out of concrete, and you know, it's just it's lovely.
Yeah, so he did design so Lubetkin did design these housing estates in the 50s and 60s in Bethnal Green and the Cranbrook estate, but I think the figure that Toth is supposed to be most closely patterned after, but again, remember this is all happening in Britain, and the film makes a big deal about the American context. So I'm not sure how much these parallels actually work. But in terms of the personality of Toth, I think he's very clearly supposed to be patterned after this figure, Erno Goldfinger, who was Hungarian Jewish, born in Budapest, which, again, the parallels are obvious there with the Laszlo Toth figure. He was famous, if not infamous, for a series of towers that he built, starting with the Balfron Tower, and then the Carradale House, Glen Kerry House, then his most famous of them, Trellick Tower.
Very famous.
Yeah.
The service tower to the left of it, and the skyway is running. And people who are vaguely familiar with architectural know this from like council estate in Britain.
Yeah, this building, you know, this has been one of the, I think, like prime examples of brutalist architecture that was among the first preservation projects. A lot of brutalist architecture in Britain is really hated. There's there's an equal and vocal minority of people who really love and want to preserve these buildings. But, you know, for a long time, brutalism was kind of, you know, architecture non grata in Britain, and the Trellick Tower and people writing about the Trellick Tower and why it should be preserved and what it represents as a kind of chapter in British architectural history and planning and what it means culturally. I think that really began to turn the tide in the public imagination and reception. I think now, though, I think it was sold off to a private equity developer. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's what happened.
Yeah, Trellick,
you can buy a very expensive flat there now.
Yeah, Trellick got heavily gentrified. The other one, Balfour, yeah. Not so much. But in any case, like, it's interesting because Goldfinger, during his lifetime, was very much vilified in the press. He also did he designed the building for the Daily Worker.
They made a horribly slanderous movie about him, Goldfinger, right?
Well, you're joking, but it's true, actually, that Ian Fleming, I think, did name the villain Goldfinger because of Erno Goldfinger. Wow. Isn't that true, Ross?
Yeah, he's the direct inspiration. Right. Apparently, Ian Fleming was golfing, and his friend who had to work with Goldfinger was going on about this architect and his horrible mood swings, like this very controlling, humorless man who just was so exacting in his vision. And this is, again, this is where I feel like the Laszlo Toth character, because he has these very violent mood swings whenever his vision is compromised in any way. He's supposed to be invoking or evoking the character of Goldfinger. But also, even his buildings were vilified. So Trellick Tower, many people believe, was the basis for J.G. Ballard's High Rise, which is
an absolute
classic. Definitely read it. But yeah, very dark and harrowing vision of the future.
Let's just address the elephant in the room. I'm sorry to cut it.
No. So what is brutalism? Is that what you're going to say?
Brutalism is the aesthetic of Clockwork Orange.
Yeah. Well, right. Okay. Yes. And those are important brutalist buildings from the Thamesmere estate that are featured there. Brutalism on film is also heavily, if you've ever seen Get Carter, the Michael Caine movie from the early 70s, there's a car chase scene and this like big hulking monstrosity of a concrete parking garage. And that's the Gateshead multi-story car park, which is in Newcastle, and I think which has since been demolished. Okay, so what is brutalism and how is it different from, you know, the international style and high modernist style? Well, they share a lot of things in common, but the emphasis in brutalist architecture is that, I think, twofold. There's a certain aesthetic that is associated with it, where there's an emphasis on like raw materials, especially concrete, and featuring them as prime. And those dominate the visual field. There's no attempt to hide the making, like the physical materiality of the construction, through whether that's the shape, the geometric space, or the roughness of the material, or again, how raw any material used for it is. Brick too, but primarily with concrete. And it's meant, brutalist buildings are meant to kind of, assimilate with their environment in some sense. Like the materials are supposed to change and alter with the changing, you know, climate conditions or their use within the community or, you know, how people find their own like lived experience dominated by the space and by the structure. They're really monumental often. So as opposed to international style or high modernist buildings, there isn't the same emphasis on the lightness of the form. They're heavy, they're tough, they're meant to withstand. And I think this is the second part of brutalism, at least for me. It's really married to an ethic. And that's the name of this book by a critic named Rainer Banham, who kind of wrote the first sort of comprehensive theory of brutalist architecture. And it was called Brutalism, Ethic or Aesthetic. And it's kind of both. The ethic of brutalism is one that is meant to serve people and replicate a kind of experience, and especially working class experience of life in a certain time and place. Britain in post-war Britain is a country that needed to rebuild. Lots of it was reduced to rubble from aerial bombings, from the Blitz. You have a big population explosion, all of these demobilized soldiers coming back from Europe to Britain. They need places to live. And you have, I think, a British society looking at itself and deciding what kind of society it wants to be after the war. You know, this is very much hand in hand with like the birth of the welfare state, and housing policy that serves the people in ways that hadn't really been done before. But it's a Britain that needs to show it can withstand and has withstood these challenges of the first part of the 20th century. You know, and also Britain finds itself in a reduced capacity after the post-war period, not just within Britain itself, but, you know, beyond. Its empire is rapidly declining. You have, you know, like the, you know, the, I guess, the death of the Raj 2 years after the end of the war in 1947. You have, you know, lots of ambivalence about what Britain's position as a colonial imperial power should be or will be in the future. And there's a kind of looking inward to Britain itself and, you know, how will the country present itself to its citizens in this, you know, new part of the century, approaching the next. Ross, you want to chime in a little bit more?
Yeah. So, I mean, I kind of view, or I've always viewed brutalism as kind of the last gasp of utopian modernism. And it was kind of, again, it was a polemical response within the modern movement, specifically to the kind of depoliticized Scandinavian new empiricism that briefly flourished after the war in Britain. So the Smithsons disdainfully referred to it as the Swedish retreat from modernism, this kind of very anesthetized, bland, later on, Owen Hatherley, who is a brilliant reader of and interpreter of brutalism, would refer to it as kind of IKEA modernism. So Rainer Banham, who Susanna mentioned just a minute ago, was a very important interlocutor in terms of theorizing and, you know, really championing this movement. He was a writer of great charisma, probably best known for his work on modernism, which is Theory and Design in the First Machine Age, I believe. But then later he wrote these books after he moved to L.A. He was kind of a counterculture figure in the 60s and 70s. He was initially a big proponent of brutalism, even though he later abandoned it. So he thought that the new brutalists were these kind of analogs of the angry young men who were playwrights in Britain in the 50s, around the same time, just slightly before.
And yeah, these are the, you know, the people that are at the forefront of like the kitchen sink drama movements of people like John Osborne and Alan Sillitoe. And, you know, again, people who really center working class life and experience as legitimate, who are, you know, from that class and who center that experience as legitimate grounds for art, you know, artistic expression and endeavor. You know, so it's also, I think, not a coincidence that a lot of the best known brutalist architectural examples, I mean, they're in urban areas, they're in London, but they're also in northern cities and towns. And they are associated with, like, you know, public housing, public institutions for education. Like the Smithsons had a really famous secondary school that put them, you know, that gave them a global reputation. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Ross.
Oh, no, it's fine. Yeah, and that's helpful, especially because I don't know the Angry Young Men that well.
All I know is Angry Young Men. That's all I know. Yeah, people, you know, like the Look Back in Anger is a key text. Actually, there's a woman, an angry young woman, Sheila Delaney, who's A Taste of Honey, a play, is later turned into a film. That's very influential as well. So, you know, all of this is kind of part and parcel of the cultural scene of Britain at the time. There's also in the visual arts, people like Eduardo Paolozzi, who's the son of Italian immigrants, and who popularizes this like rough collage, bricolage style. Oh, kitty. In his artwork. So, you know, it's all kind of part of this, you know, late 1940s, 1950s through the early 60s cultural scene.
Yeah. So, so the way that, and Banham again is a great writer, he talks about brutalism as something between a slogan and a brickbat flung in the public's face. He talks about its bloody mindedness. So it's sort of just, it's sort of monumental character that you mentioned a bit earlier. And Banham lists three characteristics, three criteria for the new brutalism toward the end of the article. The first being its memorability as an image, the second being clear exhibition of structure, so not hiding anything, and then valuation of materials as found. And then again, this is the second and third criteria really have to do with the idea of honesty of materials. And yeah, Britain and to a lesser extent Japan, which all were kind of the were the original places where brutalism flowered as a movement. Britain really being the locus classicus of this. But in the United States, of course, it's very much associated with university libraries. There are lots of great examples of this in like New Haven or in Montreal and Toronto, Chicago. There's just tons of great
stuff. The Bobst Library at NYU, which there's a bit of an allusion to it in this movie because one of Laszlo's first works in the New World is building the private study for this industrialist. And during a dinner party, someone says, you know, I read a cool short story about an infinite library talking
oh,
about...
Oh, yeah, yeah. I kind of the Borges story.
About the Borges story. And that story was the inspiration for the Bobst Library.
Okay. I didn't know that, actually, about the... I didn't know the Bobst Library was supposed to have been influenced by the Borges story. I'll have to
it's an interesting story. Is part of that story is that you... I forget exactly how it happens, but you live your entire life in this library, just sort of reading it section by section, and you'll never be able to read all of it. And at when you're ready to die, you just leap down a infinite corridor. And of course,
oh God,
Bobst is best known today for a spat of suicides, 10 years ago of people jumping. Yeah. So now they had to erect huge glass windows to prevent people from committing suicide there.
Right. Well, that's awful. and I think to Ross's point too, a lot of the reason why brutalist architecture has maybe not the best reputation in the United States is that, you know, brutalist architecture tends to be associated with big institutional buildings like statism in this way. So like, you know, the government center in Boston is often called like a brutalist building. I don't really know that it is necessarily, or often any kind of big monolithic architecture is often referred to as brutalist or Soviet, or, you know, in these very disparaging ways that, I think are more redolent of, how Americans feel about those things than the actual building itself. Criticism of this kind of architectural style is certainly not limited to the United States. Again, as I mentioned before, in Britain, you know, there's a lot of opposition to brutalist architecture as it was first becoming manifest. And then, of course, over the years, as it became this kind of dominant visual vocabulary, like many things, and especially with buildings that were funded by public councils and municipal councils, funding is cut, or, you know, architects who kind of deal with this aesthetic vocabulary, but who aren't necessarily the most inspired or just kind of imitators of, better architects like the Smithsons or Dennis Lasdin or whomever, you know, they get these contracts, they build these structures that are not necessarily built with a population in mind as they should be, or are allowed to fall into dereliction or disrepair. And like, you know, nothing really looks good if you don't clean it, if you don't maintain it. You know, a lot of opposition to, let's say, a high rise housing estate comes from the fact that, like, well, if the elevators break down, you need them, and they're not fixed because the council won't fix them, you're not going to, you know, the whole building itself is going to kind of fall into disrepair. Yeah,
let me add something here.
It's sort of a victim of, you see this here too. I mean, it's a victim of circumstance in that way.
Another example from the U.S. context that people who live in Bushwick area will recognize is the Woodhull Hospital on Broadway. And, you know, people... I think, you know, see this building every day. It's by far the largest building in North Brooklyn. And very few know that this was a award-winning brutalist design by the architectural firm Kalman and McKinnell. They designed it in the 1960s. Say it again, Sean.
I said it looks like the fucking Death Star, man.
Well, the design of it is actually a factory concept for a hospital, where patients are meant to go in on one end and follow various assembly line type paths and come out cured on the other end. And the sort of dark and industrial facade of it was, I think a lot of people just assume that it's like a dirty structure today, like the Statue of Liberty. Like, it's not supposed to look like that, but it is.
Right.
It's supposed to look like a factory that cures people. And it was an incredibly popular design, not only in terms of its appearance, but also the content of it, the interior of it, because every patient was supposed to get their own room. That's why it was so massive. But the funding was cut many times during the process of the building of it. You know, it's it was also the construction of it was delayed. And so by the time it's completed in the early 1970s, New York City is in a financial crisis. And as a result of that, we get the reputation of this hospital as one of the worst places you can end up in New York.
Yeah. Right. And this is emblematic of what the fate of brutalism more broadly. So, it really, the heyday of brutalism is the second half of the 50s through the early 70s. This is when you get the spate of, every major university in North America, especially the U.S. and Canada, having these libraries in this style. So, of course, the BOPs that you mentioned, Regenstein, which I spent a lot of time at when I was in Chicago.
SUNY Purchase, where I went in the 90s, very brutalist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were just in Montreal. We saw the McLennan, which is the library there.
Montreal is also home to a very famous brutalist housing development, the Habitat Suisse-en-Sup, which is Moshe Safdie. And you can actually see some of that, too, in the film, in Laszlo Toth's work. But, at Penn, the old building of architecture and design was sort of brutalist. The Yale School of Architecture, I guess you could call that a brutalist building. I went to grad school in the UK, and that's where I really fell in love with brutalist architecture, like spending a lot of time in these buildings. So the University of Edinburgh, the main library there was built in 1961, very much a brutalist building. The David Hume Tower, which I think has a different name now, but was where the English department was. It's this, massive. Sorry? Yeah.
They canceled.
That's right. Yeah, they did. They did. So it's now like George Square Tower or something. I spent a lot of time in this building and, they as maybe hulking or, dwarfing on a human scale, it was on the exterior, which I like. I mean, I like the sublimity of that. On the interior, you have these enormous vistas. You have, these bands of light that penetrate. And I mean, I think they're really fantastic buildings. Personally, but I understand why they're not everyone's cup of tea, so to speak. That said, though, none of the stuff that Laszlo Toth really makes in the Brutalist is brutalist architecture.
Yeah, and there is so like
that's a problem, and at least for me, really expecting this to be about somebody trying to build.
You might
have
put your finger on it when you said that the directors and writers might have just been trying to be clever.
I do think so.
Way to deal with like giant movements like brutalism. Right. It's just using for like a little clever one-off in the title.
The director is 36 and probably started making the movie, two or three years ago. So, he's a young man wrestling with some pretty high ideas and doesn't totally get all the way there. I assume that the structure of the film was also meant to be somehow brutalist in a way, which I don't know if it really worked.
Yeah. So just to close out the history of brutalism, like the kind of fate of it can be seen as kind of split in Britain itself, which is, again, the sort of homeland of brutalism, between these council housing estates that have fallen into disrepair largely. Again, they were much more topographical, attentive to their like situatedness within an urban, pre-existing urban setting. But as is often the case, and as happens in the movie, there were cost-cutting measures, and there were famous or infamous disasters that happened. So there was this major fire that broke out at Ronan Point in 1968.
It's another housing, a council estate in Britain as a brutalist design, reminiscent of Goldfinger. This huge structural, like electrical fire, was caused by a faulty electric tea kettle, which is like the most British thing ever, I think.
Yeah.
So it's really unfortunate. Yeah, really horrible.
The destruction of Ronan Point and then Pruitt Igo in St. Louis are seen as the UK and US kind of end dates of modernism. But then again, there is an alternate history too, that the sort of more high-end brutalism, sort of the Barbican estate that was made for much wealthier residents, and then of course the Smithsons Economist building, those are still in very good form, very well upkept, and to this day are, you know, seen as sort of iconic expressions of brutalism. Of course.
Although I will say, again, a lot of people, you know, the National Theater is sort of a beloved example of one, at least from the exterior. But there are many who say that, like, the space and how massive it is, it's not that well suited for stage productions. It's very difficult for the actors to kind of conquer such a, you know, these cavernous auditoria. So, I mean, that's the thing with brutalism. You know, you have this ideal, you have these architects who are really trying to think about serving a community, serving a society, but, you know, at the very least, a building has to serve its you know, stated function, whether it's a theater or a school or a place to live. And, you know, some of them do it better than others. And even if they, on an aesthetic level, you know, are impressive or sublime or, you know, move you in this way, if, you know, like, those basic functions aren't served, like, you know, whether the building, it's hard to tell that the building's really successful.
Yeah. And so it went through these dark decades, especially being vilified just in the general public by Prince Charles. The quote that you...
Oh yeah, I wrote the quote for you, Ross, if you want to read it.
Yeah. So you referred to the ABK Architects, along with Richard Rogers, prize-winning entry for the Sainsbury wing of the National Gallery as, quote...
Which is like an expansion of the National Gallery.
Carbuncle.
Yeah. A monstrous carbuncle on the face of a much-loved and elegant friend. So yeah, eventually that was replaced by the postmodern architects, their entry, which was Venturi and Scott Brown's. So in any case, like, for probably 2.5 decades, it was seen as kind of this horrible mistake that architecture had fallen into before, I guess, there was a reappraisal of it beginning in the mid-aughts to late-aughts. And through the 2010s, which...
I just want to say, I was ahead of this curve by a few years.
Yeah, yeah.
Grand-worthy, right? Like, that's a lot of what the London Review of Books article, Ross, that you sent me yesterday, Strange Angry Objects by Owen Hatherley. It's very much about, like, the legacy of the buildings and the legacy of the aesthetic and the legacy of the ethic, right, of brutalism. Because we in the 21st century... can look back upon this and, like, me, my first gut reaction is like Clockwork Orange, you know, like the Thames Estate, Susanna, that you were talking about, which looms obviously very large in it. But, like, there's a deeper and more complicated legacy that I think we all have to confront. Part of that legacy is that they're really Graham worthy, right?
Oh, yeah. Like,
they are. Yeah. Yes, that's absolutely true.
A photograph of, like, the Ministry of Transportation, or I think I have one of those little architecture books, which is like modernist bus stops in, like, the former Soviet Union. You know, these are very, 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 very attractive to us on, like, line up a bunch of images in a row and consume them sort of way, you know?
Yeah.
And Ross, what's the building that's in the Molchat Doma on the album cover?
Oh yeah,
that people were TikToking.
Yeah, I'm forgetting that the name of that one. There are a bunch of them. The ones from, like, the sort of space age structures in the Eastern Bloc and former Yugoslavia and USSR. Like, this all, like, in the 2010s. Again, it's funny because Tumblr is usually remembered as, like, a site for, like, social justice and identity politics expression, kind of very strange politics of the early 2010s. But what I most remember it for is, like, all these architecture image blogs, which some of them, like, and I'm not making this up, Fuck Yeah Brutalism and various others.
I fucking love brutalism.
Yeah, I fucking love brutalism. Yeah. All these things, like, these are the blog. Like, and again, like, Hatherley points out very, I think, astutely in his review of all these different works, that from the very beginning, from the 50s onward, and again, this is clear in Banham's whole emphasis on the memorability of images, it was intended to be these kind of stark, very consumable images, like these, and you know, the kind of primordial appearance that they had often belied, you know, the kind of elegant interiors, kind of very generous interiors that they often had, which were also sometimes features. But usually most of these images were like exterior shots that were shown.
Empty, you know, of people too.
Right? Yeah.
Empty of people usually.
Yeah. And that's an interesting thing too. You know, the Smithsons, Alison and Peter Smithson, really insisted that their buildings be photographed first, you know, without people and then with people, you know, and they do exist in a kind of different visual idiom. But of course, you know, the point of a building is to, you know, be part of a built environment that people interact with and, you know, use and kind of make their own. So, you know, there's kind of, I guess, a myopia of some of these architects and their vision, which, you know, I guess is what we're meant to think about the architect in the Brutalist film too. But the thing is, like, he's very uncompromising about one specific aspect of his designs. Like, I mean, he certainly is able to convince anybody, you know, for the Doylestown project, which dominates the first part of the film, he's able to speak persuasively and convince, you know, anyone opposing the design. He's able to explain how and why his design will serve the community, and doesn't seem to have a problem with that, and kind of expects that he'll be misunderstood. But then he's uncompromising about the dimensions of the building and the height of the ceilings versus the building's overall width. And, you know, there is a specific reason for that, which we find out in the second half of the film.
Hey, folks. Sean KB here. Just a reminder that our show relies on your support. So if you enjoy what we do and you want to hear more excellent bonus content, you can become a patron at patreon.com/theantifada. It's cheap, there's a ton of content, and it would mean everything to us. So thank you, and we'll see you behind the paywall.